You're listening to GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers, now available on iTunes and all other podcast platforms, with new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. GDA Podcast showcases insightful conversations from the best thought leaders, educators, policy experts, motivators, and storytellers on the keynote speaking circuit today. Want today's guest at your next event? Call GDA Speakers at 214-420-1999 or visit gdaspeakers.com. And now, here's this episode of GDA Podcast with hosts Scale and Kyle Davis. Enjoy.
Mike Abrashoff took command of the worst performing ship in the Navy's Pacific Fleet. 12 months later, it was the best ship in the entire Navy, using the same crew. How? Well, the transformation began when Abrashoff was working to see the ship through the eyes of his crew and learning to lead differently. Many leadership lessons that he learned were heralded in the Harvard Business Review and Fast Company. Dozens of publications have cited Abrashoff's tale as an inspiring lesson for businesses. Leaders identify with his story of being accountable for the results in an environment where they don't make the rules. He wrestled with an extreme version of the management challenges business face today, and he won. Welcome to today's episode of GDA Podcast, Mike Abrashoff.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Doing great, Kyle. How are you doing? And Gail.
Yeah, I'm living the dream one day at a time.
Oh, I am so excited to have you on here, Mike. I've known you for years, and I've been in your audience. I love your book, and I just think it'll be really interesting to dive into this. But maybe for the people that haven't had the benefit of being in your audience, you could just give a brief version of, you know, your background with the Navy and what happened on the Benfold.
Sure. So I get command of a destroyer, and it was one of our newest. But it was also one of our poorest performers, and it wasn't the technology that was keeping them from being the best. The crew wasn't engaged, and I didn't get to choose our missions. I didn't get to change anybody out. I couldn't choose my crew. I couldn't go back and ask for more money. And so what I decided to do was to change my leadership style and connect with them and then empower them to take ownership of their ship. And what happened was they turned their own ship around, and in 15 months, we got the trophy for being the best ship in the Pacific Fleet. In years 3 and 4 after I left, Benfold got the award for best ship in the entire U.S. Navy. So one of the things that we all struggle with in business and in government is how to create something that is sustainable for the long term. And I'm convinced it starts with leadership and how we show up and how we engage the people we're trying to influence.
I know that one of your chapters in your book is lead by example. How important is that?
Well, there can be no daylight between what you do and what you say, because everybody is watching you. And so, for example, if I walked down the passageway and saw trash on the deck, I'd bend over and pick it up. And I guarantee in the history of the Navy, no captain has ever picked up trash off the deck. But if I walked past it, it would send a signal that I approve of it. And what you, condone is what you approve. And you send a signal that we can get by doing just a little bit less. And what I wanted to do was to raise the standards and show everybody, if you see something that's wrong, don't walk past it, fix it, and take ownership.
I remember, and I'm really kind of absolutely going to – I forgot the coach's name, but he was the former coach of Notre Dame, and he was coming to my high school to talk to a few football players on my team about going to play football there. And I remember him walking down the hallway with my head football coach, and the two of them are walking down the hallway, and all of a sudden, I wish I remembered this guy's name, he bent over and picked up trash that he saw in our hallway at our school, and it just like – everybody's like, why'd you do that? And he's like, well, you know, can't have trash. And it made like an impact on everybody, even their coach that I had that was like a real father figure to me.
That's awesome.
And you remember to this day?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So I'm sure when you walk in somebody else's business or in a restaurant, if you see trash, you know, you kind of think, gee, their standards aren't the standards that I've seen in the past.
Yep.
You know, another thing that you talk about, or I believe it's even a chapter in your book, is the climate of trust. And I remember that the distrust of your predecessor was so high. If I recall correctly, they like almost celebrated when he left. So when it's that bad, how do you shift things and create an environment where people trust you?
So it was that bad. They actually stood and cheered when he left the ship for the final time. And I was totally embarrassed and horrified at the same time. And in that moment, it hit me, before I can ask them to change, I need to change, and that I need to become a better leader. So that's when I started putting myself in their shoes and viewing the operation through their eyes. And I'll never forget a sailor, I asked him why we were here, and he says, well, we're here to get the captain promoted. And I'm thinking, you know, getting the captain promoted would be a great thing, but that's not why we're here. You know, we're here to stay safe. We're here to keep our fellow citizens safe. So what happened was, there was no connection to what they were doing to our purpose. And so I put myself in their shoes and then tried to connect with them about what our purpose is and their role in it and how it's going to keep us safe and how it's going to keep our fellow citizens safe. And I found that 50, 60% of my job was effectively communicating. And everybody complains about millennials today. And I kind of laugh because guess what? Gail, your parents and my parents complained about us.
Right.
You know, they said that we were worthless and we would never amount to anything. Right. And the millennials are going to be just fine. It's the challenge of how do you engage them on their terms so that you can get them to have a sense of urgency and a sense of ownership. And you can't order that by sitting in the captain's chair. You got to be out and about, and it's hard work. But if you get it right, it's awfully rewarding, and that's where the satisfaction comes from.
How old were you during the time that you had this responsibility?
I was 36 years old.
Okay.
And I used to lie awake at night wondering if the taxpayers knew what a mistake the Navy made putting me in charge of this $1.2 billion destroyer, because as the events of the USS Fitzgerald a couple of weeks ago show, you know, it's a serious business and it's a very dangerous business. And the captain is responsible, you know, 24/7. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm asleep in my cabin, I'm responsible. Whether I'm off the ship, I'm still responsible. And one person or a small group of people letting down their guard can lead to tragic consequences. So it's very serious, and you tend to grow into the role. And I was terrified when I took it, but once I realized the results we could achieve by engaging my 310 shipmates and getting them to have a sense of ownership and getting them to have a sense of urgency, they helped lift burdens off my shoulders, and so I was able to sleep better at night. But those leaders who don't get it have tremendous burdens on their shoulders, and the way to share that responsibility is to empower your people and to engage them. And I'm convinced they'll rise to the occasion and help you out.
So, you know, listening to kind of what you had to say, and I jotted down some phrases you said, empowering them to take control of their own ship, viewing the operation through their eyes, and there was really no connection to the purpose. And I'm going to bring another military figure in, but you know, if you read McChrystal's book or if you've talked with him or at any length of time, he kind of has that same, you know, idea of, you know, that's how we, you know, have to operate. And it's more of a empowering everybody instead of maybe doing the more traditional old school military of, you know, here's your order, just do it. And so I'm wondering if that just doing it more dictatorship kind of
command.
Leadership or command style was the captain prior to you. And then when you made that pivot into empowering your people, how long did it take and when did it start gaining traction?
So, you know, the military invented command and control leadership. telling people what to do and how to do it and giving orders. And you know what? It used to work. When I graduated from the Naval Academy in 1982, I was sent to a ship that was very rudimentary, and we only had to carry out one mission area at any one time. And so the captain could direct that and control it. But fast forward to USS Benfold, which, you know, today costs probably $2.4 billion. We have to do six or seven mission areas all at the same time with 35% fewer crew members than we had on that single mission ship back in 1982. So the technology is forcing us to up our game. And if we focus on one or two mission areas, you know, we can probably do reasonably well, but the other five or six are going to fall apart. And our job is to get all the missions accomplished at the same time to the best of our ability. And being a one-man show doesn't work anymore. And especially with millennials, they don't want to be barked at. They want to understand why. They want to know what the purpose is, and they want to know what's in it for them. And so leaders in today's environment, both military, government, and business, have to up their game in connecting with them. And I forget the second part of your question, Kyle.
But basically, when you came in and the previous leader was probably more this command control captain of the ship, and then you transitioned into this empowering your people and giving them ownership over their role and then having that then take ownership of the ship, what was that like, and when did you start to see traction in that endeavor?
The whole crew thought it was going to be the flavor of the month and that something bad would happen and I would revert to the old style. But it took me months to build up that trust. But the thing that crystallized it was I'd been in command about 3 months. We had left San Diego. We're on our way to the Middle East. And we're doing a major exercise with two other ships. And it was the exercise was designed to increase our ability to defend ourselves. And the exercise was supposed to be over the following Friday afternoon at 5 p.m., at which point we were to enter Pearl Harbor for a night in Waikiki. And the way we enter port in the Navy is by the date of rank of the senior officer on each ship. And I was the junior guy by date of rank, and I was the youngest captain by age. So we would always go in last. And that morning, that Friday morning, the exercise was unexpectedly over at 9 a.m. We had achieved all the objectives. The admiral declared it a success. And we're all sitting off the coast of Waikiki, steaming in circles, wasting fuel, because that's what the plan called for. And I'm thinking, you know, this is stupid. Why don't we go into port and get an extra half day in Waikiki? So I called the captain of the senior ship where the admiral was embarked. And I said, why don't you ask to go in early? And he said, I can't. I've got an engineering problem. I can only fix it at sea. I called the captain of the second ship, and he excoriated me on the radio for every sailor to hear, just berated me up and down and said that we should go in last. And so then I picked up the phone and I called the admiral, and he demanded to know why I thought Benfold should be allowed to go in before everybody else. And I said, well, sir, we're wasting fuel. We're wasting taxpayers' money. I've got a piece of broken equipment I can only fix in port. And I said, besides, I want to put my crew on the beach early in Waikiki today. And to my utter amazement, my hand was trembling as I was holding the radio handset, you know, appealing to him. And he said, permission granted. And I was two decks above the operations center where 30 sailors were on watch. And when the admiral said, permission granted, I could hear cheering through two decks of steel. Now, we have four engines on a ship, and our normal configuration is only to steam on one engine because it's our most fuel efficient. And we can go up to 18 knots on one engine. And so everywhere we go, unless it's an emergency, we're programmed 18 knots or less. But you can do 24 knots on two engines and use twice the amount of fuel. You can do 27 knots on three engines, and you can do 31 knots on four engines. When the admiral said permission granted, I put all four engines online, came up to full power, entered Pearl Harbor at full speed. And when my ship is at full power, it is so powerful, it kicks up a rooster tail of water that's two stories high. I mean, everybody knew we were screaming. And we tie up at 10:15, cruise off the ship by 10:45 on their way to Waikiki. Never did save one drop of fuel that day. Next day, we get underway to continue our transit to the Middle East. And by this time, I had been interviewing every sailor on the ship, each one individually. And it was my way of getting to know them and to set the standards of letting them know that, you know, I don't care what your age is. I don't care what your rank is. I don't care how long you've been in this organization. You can come to work every day and challenge 241 years worth of rules and regulations and customs and traditions and policies and procedures. And so I use these interviews to set the framework of what I expected of them and what they could expect of me. And the first sailor that morning came in and said, "Captain, can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "It seems to us, the crew, that you don't care if you ever get promoted again." And I said, "What on earth are you talking about?" He said, "What you did for us yesterday," he said, "you had nothing to gain. You did it for us. We want you to know we got your back." And when you create trust with your crew, the sky is the limit. When your people have your back, there's nothing that you can't accomplish. And it was an accident of how I created it, but that was a signature moment that the crew knew that we were going to do business differently and that I meant what I said, that we own this.
I think that's an awesome story.
That is an awesome story. I read somewhere that someone said that what you did is like the ultimate of organizational transformation. And I wonder how it differs turning a crew who all lives together on a ship, turning that around, what the challenges are versus, you know, a typical business setting. It's got to be tougher, I would think, being out on a ship together.
It's different. And out of, you know, a 24-month, you know, commanding officer's tour, we're probably at sea 11 months. But the other 13 months, we're sitting at the pier in port, and we go to and from work every morning and leave every afternoon, just like every other worker in America. So in that regard, you know, in some instances, it's no different than, you know, being in an office park somewhere. And being at sea for 6 or 7 months at a time, one of the berthing compartments on the Fitzgerald that was ruptured had housed 106 sailors in one berthing compartment. And you're sleeping in bunk beds that are triple high. So it's not two bunks, it's three bunks. And so even though you are close and I've got more direct access to people, that closeness also creates tension. Sure. Because you have zero personal space. So, you know, people always look at me and look for the differences. Well, you had your crew within 505 feet of you. That's true, but that also presents additional challenges that we have to deal. So no situation is alike, and one is not better than the other. It's understanding what they are and then how to deal with it.
So you mentioned the USS Fitzgerald, and we were talking about it prior to going to record, and I understand that you had a family member that was on there. So maybe, how about this? If you could kind of give a little bit of insight as to what happened and then maybe opine off of that, I think that would be beneficial for those who maybe don't know what we're talking about because it has been a couple of weeks, or and also it'd be, I think, great to have, you know, shed some light on that.
So it was the destroyer that was in a collision with a Filipino freighter off the coast of Yokosuka, Japan, which is right by Tokyo. And to be fair, it is some of the busiest shipping traffic in the entire world. And I remember being there as an ensign. I'm 21 years old. I'm the officer of the deck. And all you see are ships all around you. And it's 3 a.m. and the captain's asleep, and I'm here cursing him, like, "What are you doing sleeping? You should be up here helping me." So it is very harrowing, it is very challenging. And the ship had just gone through a lengthy overhaul where they were in port, you know, 6 or 7 straight months. Mm-hmm. So coming off that, your crew is rusty. Personnel may have even changed out. They haven't operated together as a team. And you're in busy shipping lanes. In that situation, and there were nights on Benfold when I slept in my chair on the bridge. Because, you know, you had to be there. You have to have a sixth sense of, you know, when danger is about you. And so I'm not going to say that I would have been in my chair sleeping that night the Fitzgerald had their accident. But in similar situations on Benfold, I was always in my chair all night long, getting woken up every 15 minutes to, you know, to give guidance. And to give experience to people who have never seen this before. And so when I first saw the pictures of the Fitzgerald, I knew right away that the Fitzgerald was at fault. And of course, the investigation hasn't come out and it may come up with some extenuating circumstances. But just like we have rules that guide us when we're driving, like, you know, stop lights and stop signs and yield signs, we have something called International Rules of the Road that dictate how ships maneuver based on their relative position to one another. And based on where the freighter hit the Fitzgerald, it was immediately obvious to me within like the first 2 seconds that the freighter is what's called the stand-on vessel, where they have the right to maintain their course. And the Fitzgerald is what's called the give way vessel, and they're required to maneuver to avoid the collision. So right off the bat, I could tell that absent being in a restricted, you know, channel, which has its own rules, in the open ocean, my armchair analysis is that without having benefit of any of the data, just by looking where the impact was, that the Fitzgerald was at fault.
So I know that there was like some issues with regards to when it was called in, and, you know, I think it was like the communications area that was taken out and everything else. And it was like an hour behind or hour later that the Japanese Coast Guard was like alerted. What is going, what is the captain of that ship going through during that time? Is it like everybody to their battle stations, let's go? I mean, what's happening during that period of time?
So the captain was injured in the collision. The captain's cabin is right there where the bow of the freighter hit. Mm-hmm. And he sustained a head injury. I don't know how serious. So he was incapacitated. But the first thing that you have to do is to tighten all of the watertight hatches on the ship so that the flooding doesn't spread to the rest of the ship. And so every space, every 10 or 15 feet, there's a watertight hatch or door that you close to keep flooding from spreading to the rest of the ship. And I suspect that what happened was there was a berthing compartment right where the Filipino freighter hit, and they tried to evacuate as many people as they could. But at some point, the water was starting to come out the hatch, and they had to close it with sailors still in the compartment in order to save the rest of the ship.
So, I mean, I guess as a non-military person, what's that decision like? I mean, you always hear, you know, everybody comes home, you know, and obviously the bodies were found. But what's that decision like to save the ship? In that instance,
fortunately, I've never had to make it, so I can't tell you.
Okay,
but I can tell you that what drove me every day in everything that I did was to ensure that I never had to write the letters to any parents telling them that their sons or daughters weren't coming home. And so it's something that, you know, ship captains take personally and take seriously. And so what drove me wasn't my next promotion. Mm-hmm. what drove me every day was putting ourselves in a position to control our own destiny and win overwhelmingly if we ever got called into combat. The day I took command, that ship was not in a position to control its own destiny. And you're never perfect. You're never satisfied. But with that crew taking ownership, I'm convinced we would have been able to face any situation that was thrown at us.
Well,
and survive.
I believe you. I am curious, though, when it comes to the Benfold, I'm looking at the pictures right now. What was the mission set for the Benfold? And is it and you said it was a Pacific fleet as well?
Yeah, it's based out of Yokosuka, Japan, where the Fitzgerald is based. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was based out of San Diego. We periodically rotate our ships to and from Japan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it had 6 or 7 missions. We carry Tomahawk cruise missiles that we can launch at fixed targets ashore. Mm-hmm. We have guns that we can use to support Marines as they land on a foreign beach. Mm-hmm. We have a sonar and anti-submarine warfare capability. We have missiles that we can shoot down incoming aircraft and other missiles. And we can search the electromagnetic spectrum looking for enemy signals and communications so that we could intercept them. And so while the ship is at sea, all those missions are going on or can be going on.
So it really is kind of like a Swiss Army knife of Navy vessels.
And I've got a helo deck, and my ship didn't carry helos, but I can land them, refuel them, and control them. And vector them to where the submarine is or search and rescue mission or whatever. So, it's a Swiss Army knife. When you wake up in the morning, you never know how the day is going to play out because it's changing every day.
I think that's super cool. I have a lot of my friends, are in the military, were Army and Marines. So, you probably, if you were in support of like a MU, you probably had a bunch of Marines that, or at least later on, my friends probably were there. But you know, most of my friends weren't in the Navy, but those that were, almost overwhelmingly, they were all like submariners. So they're all a little bit off. And I think you know what I'm talking about, but they're just a little bit weird. But yeah.
Now, in their defense, they're also the smartest sailors.
They are.
They get. Yeah. They have the highest academic achievement. Because the complexity of their submarine is so great. But they are conditioned to religiously and blindly follow the manual no matter what it says. And they can do that to a T. But sometimes if you put them in a situation where they have to react and think outside the box of something that's not in the manual, they don't have that particular training because the submarine force doesn't value that type of thinking.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of two of my friends, and I'm gonna have to send this podcast to them later, but that were in the Navy and the submarines, and they were both 18, 19, 20 years old, like right around there, and they were operating, you know, the nuclear propulsion system and fixing it whenever it went down. And I'm just sitting here going, what was I doing at 19? I was selling knives.
Well, and you know what? They're smart and they work long, hard hours, and I don't take anything away from them.
Nothing. Yeah.
Nothing. So I couldn't do it because, for one thing, I'm 6'4" tall, and the bunks on submarines are only 6 feet long. So
right there,
I would
we had
have
a problem.
To sleep in the fetal. Yeah. I would have to sleep in the fetal position. Plus, I graduated in the top 80% of my class at the Naval Academy. So the submariners would not have me in their community. Thank goodness.
So tell us a little bit about life after the Navy. What has Mike Abershoff been doing since he left the Navy?
So got featured in Fast Company, and it became the number one reader response article in the history of Fast Company magazine. And they asked me to come speak, and I had never spoken in public before. And I followed Tom Peters as a keynote speaker.
Oh,
and I got 3 standing ovations, 150 people lined up to shake my hand. And in the audience was a professor from UCLA who ran a program one weekend a month for the poorest performing principals and administrators of the LA Unified School District. And he called me up and said, Mike, will you participate in this program? And I can't pay you anything, but will you come to LA one Saturday a month and participate? And I found out that I loved leadership development. I found that I loved helping others, you know, realize greater potential. And through this professor, I got asked to speak at the Harvard Business School and the Stanford Business School. And my mother, who's now 95, emailed me and said, what's it like speaking at institutions that would never have you as a student? And so I found out a new calling in life, and that was leadership development. And that's what I've been doing for the last 17 years. And about 6 years ago, I teamed up with a wonderful lady from Philadelphia. Her name is Stacy Cunningham. Uh-huh. And on her motivators that we were talking about earlier, she is theoretically motivated, and she developed a neat leadership journey based around my story and my beliefs. And we created a leadership roadmap of what you need to do to drive team performance. And we recently broke this up into 15 or 20 minute segments where you get an alert once a week that tasks you to do something like interview your people or read this article or watch this video. And so it's basically a 6 month virtual program that gets you to think differently about leadership and that prods you to do something experiential once a week. And we have been getting fantastic results from this program. And so that's what my new journey is to bring not just a keynote speech, but also sustainable programs to implement this leadership approach in organizations.
It's really ironic. Literally 10 minutes before we started recording this, I was talking to a client, and she was describing that, you know, she currently doesn't have a manager and that he left the position because he wasn't effective at all. And she said, you know, we had talked about a keynote speaker, and maybe there's still room for a keynote speaker, but I really am going to need somebody to come in and do almost a workshop, you know, who can really show this whole group how we can turn this around. I was like, how ironic. Let me tell you about a podcast I'm getting ready to record. So I think a lot of times, you know, of course, I love the keynote. I've been doing this for a long time, but a lot of times there's a need for a deeper dive into more of the how-to.
Exactly. And so, you know, my partner, Stacy, says, you know, I get people motivated and inspired, and then this program gives them the how-to. Mm-hmm. And what we do is pair you up with one or two other people in your organization so you go through it at the same time. And the theory being that just like when you go to the gym, if you go to the gym with a workout partner, you typically work out harder. If you go by yourself, you say, oh, I'm not feeling like doing this today. And you go home and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, get something to eat.
That's why. And so,
right. Exactly right. And that's, so what we've created is CrossFit for the corporate world.
Oh, that's a great description.
Boom. CrossFit for the corporate
world. You know, earlier before we did hit record, you started to tell us a little bit about the motivators. And I found that really interesting. I'd love for you to go over, I think it was it seven?
Or seven, yeah.
Seven different motivators.
So as part of our consulting, we focused on three different things. What your behaviors are in the organization, what your thinking style is, and what your motivators are. And there's no right or wrong thinking style. There's no wrong or right motivators. It's who you are. It's how you're wired. And so what this helps you do is to become more self-aware. And then it can help you, if you know what motivates your people, it can help you connect with them better. And so one of the seven motivators is economics. And economics is not only money, but it's also efficiency. And on this assessment, I'm off the chart on economics because when I see something that's inefficient, it drives me nuts. And so the second one And typically, you're powered by your top two motivators. And my second motivator is political. I like influencing people. But you can be aesthetically motivated. You can be altruistically motivated. You can be theoretically motivated, like my partner is. And you can be individualistic. And how you put together a team, if I had a partner who had the same motivators as me, we might not be as good as Stacy and I are because we're different and we complement each other. And so the key is to, in a scientifically valid way, understand your team's motivators so you can connect with them better. And in my own crude way, when I was in the Navy, I found this out when I interviewed sailors. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewing a sailor one day, and the ship had started to turn. Everybody was happy. They were smiling. Retention was up. Performance was up. And very arrogantly, I said to him, "How do you like the new Ben?" He said, "I hate it. I hate the Navy. I can't wait to get out." And he had 2 years left on his contract, and he was a great electronics technician. And I said to him, "Well, if you continue to perform, when you get out, I'll give you a great job recommendation. You can get a job in the electronics field paying $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year." He said, "I hate electronics. I'll have nothing to do with it." I said, "What do you want to be?" He said, "I want to be a social worker." And I literally laughed in his face. My father was a social worker. And my father made $13,000 a year. And I said to this kid, "But social workers don't make any money." And he said, "Captain, I spent my whole life in and out of foster homes." He said, "I don't care how much money I ever make. I want to make sure that what happened to me doesn't happen to any other child in this country." And I was dumbfounded. I literally did not know what to say. I ended the interview. I called him back up to my cabin 2 weeks later. And I said, "Here's the deal. I want you to find the worst performing elementary school in San Diego County, figure out what it needs, and come back and tell me." And he comes back 2 weeks later. He said, "Captain, I found the school. It's in the barrio." And I said, "What does it need?" He said, "It needs to be painted." And I said, "Here's the deal. If you round up shipmates to help you, I'll buy the paint." My 19-year-old social worker rounded up 50 shipmates. Now, these are kids, you know, who didn't start out life at the top rung of the economic ladder. And they painted that school, and they enjoyed it so much they adopted it. And after work, you know, these sailors would go over to the school and mentor elementary school students until their parents came and picked them up. And I leave the ship, and, you know, this social worker, you know, has like 8 months left in his contract. And I keep in contact with about 200 of the 310 sailors on that ship, but I never knew what happened to my social worker. And last summer, I asked my retired command master chief to put out a Facebook all points bulletin on him to find out where he is, because I wanted to talk to him and see what became of him. Turns out he never left the Navy. Today he's a senior chief petty officer, doing extraordinarily well, loves it. And one of the reasons was we gave him an outlet that allowed him to put his altruism to work. And as a result, he was happier on the job and he stayed longer. And so, you know, say you're in business, you have this great technician who works for you. You don't know anything about him or her. And you say, "Oh, I'm going to give you $20,000 more a year." And they're going to say, "You know, screw you. That's not what I'm looking for." And they're going to leave you. And so in my own crude way, I tried to find out what motivated my sailors. Mm-hmm. So that it enabled me to connect with them better. And as a result, they performed better and stayed longer in the organization. And so through this motivational assessment, we can do this a lot quicker, like in 15 minutes. And then you can use that data not only for your own self-awareness, but also for the awareness of your team.
When you're combining those motivators with the behaviors and the thinking styles, I mean, are sometimes the behaviors and thinking styles at odds with the motivators? And if so?
No. So the thinking style, there are three basic thinking styles. And it was developed by a Holocaust survivor by the name of Robert Hartman, who amassed mountains of data on what causes people to be evil. And from this data, he and his students figured out that there are three thinking styles. One is your task-oriented, one is your big-picture-oriented, and the third one is your people-oriented. And so the key is to understand what your thinking style is, and there's no right or wrong thinking style, it's how you're wired. And most people are two of the three. For example, I'm big picture and people oriented. And everybody who knows me, you know, chuckles and they say, how did that ship ever leave, you know, the harbor with me as the captain? Because I can't do anything on my own. And the answer is, if it had to come down to me to get the ship underway, I probably couldn't have done it. But I know how to harness people who are task oriented to get them to do it. And the mistake that organizations make is they have a great, you know, technician who is task oriented and has blind spots when it comes to people. And they put that technician in a management job because they're a great technician and they have no empathy for people. And as a result, they can end up doing more harm in a management position than in their technician role. And so this assessment helps leaders understand the thinking style of their people so that they can reduce risk when hiring and promoting and putting the right people in the right jobs and grooming them. And so if you have, a good task person who's also people-oriented, that's the type of person that you want to invest in leadership programs and groom them, for increased positions of leadership and responsibility. Mm-hmm. And this assessment can help you reduce your risk and find the right people to put in the right roles. And then thirdly, the behaviors. I worked with a chief operating officer of a company who was very professional, got great results, and the company paid him $2 million a year. He was miserable. And it was because he was having to adapt who he was to the management committee of five or six people. And he was afraid to, he didn't know where he stood with them. And so he was always having to adapt his behaviors to what he thought they were looking for instead of being his own natural self. So the behavior assessment can determine if you're adapting away from who you are naturally. And research has shown that if you have to adapt to be somebody you're not, you're going to be unhappy in your role. And it wasn't until this guy saw this on the chart that said, that's why I'm so unhappy at work. And then he confided that he and his wife were on the verge of getting a divorce. And he says, I'm bringing it home with me as well. So it helped him with that understanding and self-awareness, develop a new way to deal with his management committee so that he didn't have to adapt so much. And it enabled him to repair the relationship with his wife at home.
Well, there you go.
That's great. I've loved this, Mike. I think you're such a great leader, and thank you for your service to our country. And you're so humble, and I love the fact that you've taken those lessons and you're out, just helping the average Joe Blow that's just trying to keep their team on track. I mean, it's really full circle, and it's great to be a part of.
And the great thing for me is I get to choose who I work with. And Gail Davis Associates are the best in the business, and I love you, and I love working with you and your team. And we've had a great run, and I look forward to continuing working with you. And Kyle, welcome aboard. I'm going to be doing an assessment on what you think your leadership team is like at GDA and how we can improve their leadership skills.
Awesome.
Well, that'll be fun.
That'll be great.
You think she'll listen, Kyle?
No.
Yeah, that's a after work conversation.
Yeah, not gonna happen.
I'm learning.
Well, I had a good time, and to all the Submariners out there, don't kill me. And other than that, if you would like to book Mike Abershoff to come speak at your event, you can do so by contacting Gail Davis & Associates or GDA Speakers at 214-420-1999 or by going to gdaspeakers.com. For the transcript, the book, and everything else, you can go to gdapodcast.com for that. Other than that, wow, there's a lot of that. Yeah, I need to learn to speak. Maybe we could talk about that.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, folks. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to this episode of GDA Podcast, powered by GDA Speakers. If you're interested in booking today's guest, visit GDA Speakers at gdaspeakers.com or call 214-420-1999. Visit gdapodcast.com and subscribe to our newsletter to stay up to date and be informed of new episodes, blog posts, and more. Be sure to follow GDA Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at GDA Podcast, as well as Facebook at facebook.com/GDA Podcast. Thanks again, and stay tuned for more from GDA Podcast and GDA Speakers.